I'm back.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome back, Mike.
Did you miss me?
Yeah.
You did.
Well, you must have heard the results.
It was a really, really good podcast.
No, it was shambolic.
Why do you say that?
Well, we were completely lost.
You had my notes.
We did have your notes. And we had. I heard you whispering in my ear, despite the fact that you weren't in the room, but it didn't do any good. It was terrible. Terrible intro, anyway.
No.
This is much better already.
Excellent. Well, we are missing somebody today. Effie, again, unsurprisingly. Has he contacted us? Do we know?
Yeah, I think he spoke to John this morning.
Yeah. Apparently, he has a gas leak at his new house now. So Monday was water leak. Today is gas leak. I don't want to know what's going to happen on Friday.
He did clear out all of his sewage system before he started this.
So no explosive backflow.
Hopefully that's all right.
Oh, well. So what, Effie would rather be clearing out sewage than actually come to work with us in the office. I think that says a lot. Well, I'm sure we'll get by without him anyway. This is Season 3, Episode 12 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
Excellent. And in this episode, we'll be talking about Chrome, Fedora 16, Firefox 5, Adobe Air. We've got our discoveries. We've got our challenge results, Speak Your Brains, the open ballot, and much more. If you love the podcast, then you'll love Linux Format Magazine. 114 pages. No.
No.
How many pages now?
It's 114 plus 16.
That's the big hand is at 12.
Isn't that 132 with the covers? Can we include the covers?
Yeah. So now.
They're nice pictures.
Yeah. There's a lot of effort goes into those.
Yeah. With the new programming supplement, that's 132 pages of Linux love you can get every month. Subscribe at tuxradar.com/subscribe. So let's get straight into the news then. And Chrome might replace Firefox as the default web browser in Ubuntu. Mark Shuttleworth gave an interview recently and he says that it's a real possibility that Firefox might be out. He says it might not happen for a year or so because Ubuntu 12.04 is going to be an LTS release, so they don't want to make any big drastic changes for that. So they'll keep going with Firefox for a while until they can integrate Chrome fully into perhaps 12.10.
Did you say why?
I'm not really sure.
I mean,
reading the he said something in the interview about partly the fact that Google are working on Chrome OS. Chrome as a browser is getting massive speed boosts and a lot of attention for running on Linux. So although it's already a really quick browser, I still think quicker than Firefox 4. That with all this work, it's just going to get better and better.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, we've discussed it a lot, Chrome, and we've all used Chrome quite a lot. It's been my browser of choice for ages, but Firefox has caught up a long way.
A long way, it's true.
To the point that where I would be thinking, they've got to differentiate themselves from Chrome OS. One way of doing that is to stick with Firefox if the performance differences aren't that great. But then, you know, maybe Chrome's storefront is really nice. You know, maybe that has something to do with it.
There's talk on Mozilla doing something similar, though, isn't there? I hope they do. It really annoys me. There's all these great web apps that you have to go to a Chrome web store to actually find. Like the BBC Good Food magazine. It's a really, really great web app interface. It's really nice.
Yeah.
But you can't... I didn't know about it until I looked on the Chrome web store.
Well, yeah. I was telling you the other day about the Jolly Cloud app. That actually gives you access to your Jolly Cloud desktop right in the Chrome browser window, which is cool.
But it's just a HTML app.
So there's
no reason for it to be just Chrome, but they just stick them just in the... I don't understand.
It's quite interesting that these web apps are really taking off now, because what Mozilla tried with the original Mozilla Suite back in the early 2000s was to become not just a browser, but also an application platform. So a website could pump out XUL.
Really?
And actually make... You could have an application with proper clickable GTK widgets appear on your screen. I remember the only one I ever saw was for Amazon. But you went to some test site with an XUL file at the end, and inside Mozilla appeared all these buttons, clickable things. It wasn't a web page. It was actually an interface that was sent over HTTP to you. And then you could interact with Amazon's website, do searches and things.
Cool.
So at the time...
Yeah.
The Mozilla guys thought, well, this is going to be the future. We're going to make the web browser the platform. And people will send you know, toolkit layouts and everything over that. But of course, that was the early 2000s, so bandwidth was still a lot more scarce. And
And I think iOS has had a massive impact on the way people think about these things, and it has certainly helps that Google is really pushing Angry Birds for free through Chrome, and you kind of go through the apps tab.
That's a very good demonstration as well, because I played that and it's very smooth.
Although it doesn't, I tried it on my netbook, and my 1.6 Atom CPU isn't up to it.
I got a feeling some of the things in the Chrome Web Store are Flash.
Are they?
Some of them are. I don't know if Angry Birds is, but there are some other games that are definitely Flash, like some bubble popping game.
I don't think Angry Birds is. I think it's a deliberate demonstration of what you can do
doing it with Canvas and stuff.
Yeah, because I normally have Flash blocked everywhere because it's horrendous. But it'll be interesting. I've been running Firefox for the last few months, and I had some problems with it downloading things as I posted on the Linux Format site. But I installed a snapshot release of Chrome for Linux yesterday, and it's just unbelievably fast.
Oh, really?
It just feels like it's getting faster and faster, to the point where you're not exactly sure how it works.
Yeah.
You know, the startup times and things for an application of that complexity.
Yeah, I've certainly got used to it.
Yeah.
Despite installing Firefox 5 yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah, just through Arch.
Oh, was it straight in the repositories?
Yeah, it was.
Excellent.
Almost as soon as the announcement was made.
Cool.
I've had to write down the things that have changed in Firefox 5 because there's nothing really to notice when you look at it. It's got a slightly different UI, but it really should be 4.1 in old terms. Maybe not even 4.1. It's got the Do Not Track on Android, which is quite interesting. There's 85% of 4 users, it said in the changelog, use add-ons, which is quite good. Maybe they come with add-ons. Maybe that includes the add-ons bundled with Windows. What else? Improved performance everywhere on Canvas, JavaScript, memory, and networking.
Is it noticeable?
I haven't used it enough to say. Okay. But it's a lot faster than Firefox 3 used to be. I've not used Firefox in any great deal after moving to Chrome. I do like the way that it uses the same... You can get Chrome to use your window manager, but Firefox fits quite nicely into KWin, nicer than Chrome does without the borders. In the features list of 5 or 6 features, it mentions specific desktop integration improvements for Linux, but I couldn't find any further information on what those desktop integration features were. I even looked through the changelog then, and I couldn't find anything there, but there was an interesting bug that had been fixed, reported initially by Benoit Jacob, who said that he suffered from 25 decibels of hearing loss after pressing Control F with his headphones on, and Firefox created a massive ping in his ears.
Oh.
And there's a long discussion logged against this bug where they just
ruined his hearing.
Yeah, well, I think he was joking.
Oh, I hope he was.
He said he'd not heard any other app use that sound since 1974. But what followed was a long discussion on the pros and cons of actually of Firefox making this sound, and in the end it was taken out. So maybe that's the desktop integration improvement.
Meanwhile, Fedora 16 will use the BTRFS file system by default.
ButterFS.
ButterFS.
That is how you say
it. Is that really? Yeah. Really? Yeah, it sounds tasty.
How do you know that?
Because a couple of years ago at OzCon, I interviewed Valerie Aurora, who is one of the main developers on ButterFS.
Ah.
So I had to get it right. If I'd got it wrong in the first 5 minutes, she would have corrected me anyway.
Also, Chris Brown mentioned it in a system administration article way about 4 or 5 months ago.
Ah, right.
Shame on you for not remembering.
I was just testing you, honest.
But yeah, it is an awesome file system.
Well, yeah, it has all sorts of things like pooling, snapshotting, checksumming.
It's really efficient as well. When you look at those initial snippets of code that started off the whole project, you can see that it doesn't suffer from any of the legacy code that other file systems have. But as a result, it's been in kind of testing entropy for years, it seems.
Yeah, well, I think you and I were looking this up, John. I read somewhere that it's got certain features for SSD, solid state storage, flash drives. Yeah, some things to reduce wear leveling or improve wear leveling. Is that a good or a bad thing? presumably to help it. But as more and more computers are using SSDs, like even lower end netbooks, then that's a really, really good thing. having a file system that targets this, where you don't have to move heads around. So yes, you haven't got that kind of seek problem anymore on SSDs.
And you have to be careful about the number of writes you do, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes the controllers on SSDs handle that where leveling themselves, but...
This is why Fedora is a really useful, great distribution. That is going to be default, but if you've got any sense, you wouldn't run Fedora as a major production system anyway.
Yeah.
But loads of people are going to test it, and it's going to get better, and it's going to be able to say that, yeah, it's stable, it's been tested in the real world by thousands and thousands of people.
And doesn't Butterfly FS do things like scaling, shrinking, and enlarging?
It can do all that
new block
LVM
devices
kind of stuff.
It can do
straight out of a
on-write copy with very little overhead. It's just like, it sounds okay. File systems may only interest certain people, but it sounds next generation file system like, you know.
Well, it sounds like as well stuff like the pooling and the snapshotting and stuff that actually could be worked into a really good feature, like a user facing feature, you know.
Yeah,
if you're about to run
like
a
machine
system upgrade. Yeah. If you're going to run a system upgrade though, you know, then takes a snapshot, and if it screws up, you just revert to the snapshot, and
having that in the file system itself.
Yeah, it does, and I don't understand how it works, but it doesn't have to replicate it byte by byte, does it? It's not a... It doesn't take up twice the amount of space for...
No, but it can do if you want it to.
It can do, but equally it can just... It's just like a... I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I guess it can do a delta of all of those changes. Because it does compression as well. You can interleave compression into the whole thing. But I remember the conversation with Valerie being very technical, and I just kind of had to pretend that I was going along with it.
Meanwhile, Adobe... I've already said meanwhile, haven't I?
That's okay.
And then Adobe...
Can you leave that in?
More good news.
Not so good news now. Adobe has announced that they're going to drop Air support for desktop Linux. Dave McAllister, some dude from Adobe, said, way back in 1999, I predicted a significant market share for desktop Linux by 2005. I was targeting better than macOS type numbers in the 10 to 15% range. It was clear back then that Linux had found a substantial adoption as a server OS, and it seemed only time before the desktop adoption rivaled at least the other desktop. Obviously, I was wrong. So...
I think we all thought the same thing.
I think we all did. Well, so...
It's interesting to hear someone from Adobe saying that.
Yeah.
What is the Air platform? For those out there who don't know, and me.
The Air platform...
It's like super enhanced flash, isn't it, really? For example, the main Air application that I would have liked to see on Linux is Devolo make those Ethernet over the power line adapters, and their configuration panel is an Air application. So you see, it looks like a native Linux application, but it's actually cross-platform without them having to do anything, with basically what you might think is a kind of embedded flash interface in the middle, where you can click on devices, change configuration options. So it kind of it's a bit like high-level Qt in between Qt and Flash.
That sounds very clever.
Yeah. It's all right. I mean, my experience of Air on Linux has always been a bit hit and miss. It suffers from performance problems in the same way Flash does. And it's clunky and kind of difficult to install.
Yeah. Well, we all end up having so many plugins now. Air, Silverlight, Flash, and all these frameworks to run supposedly OS-independent applications. But I think it's interesting that Adobe has made this statement, because I think they're trying to counteract the usual... Well, some of the more hot-headed zealotry type of, oh, Adobe hates Linux, or Adobe, it's a secret conspiracy by Microsoft. Adobe's simply saying, look, with between 1% and 2% market share, it's just not worth our time supporting desktop Linux.
Yeah.
But they are going to support Android. So they are still going to make a Linux client, but they're saying Android's the future.
Which is true.
Yeah, not the...
That's interesting. I wonder how much extra effort it would be. But at the same time, what has the take-up of Air been? I don't know. I don't see that many Air applications around.
I play a desktop.
Oh, really?
Is Air, yeah.
How did the BBC come up with that decision?
I don't know. Well, I suppose they wanted, because the Linux community made a big noise when it first came out saying we want it on Linux. It was quite a major issue.
I've never even tried
It's a bit clunky, to be honest with you. You're better off using iPlayer. Yeah. So as long as BBC didn't cut that off again, stick with that and you'll be fine.
Is Get iPlayer working still? It wasn't so long. It was like 12 months ago that the BBC said that they were going to block access to it, and they were going to change all of the UIDs yeah. for programs but to make it really difficult.
What they didn't, I think they introduced some kind of verified, is it RTP? Oh, right. RDP? Some kind of verified stream system.
I remember, yes, you're right, RDP.
But there's stuff out there, there's Linux versions of RTP out there, RDP or whatever, that get around it. So some people have picked up Get iPlayer and rebuilt it with this support involved.
Because
so
the developer of Get iPlayer at the time said, stuff it, I'm not going to bother anymore.
Yeah, yeah, but they? Other people have picked it up, and you can get it in the AUR and Arch, and works perfectly, so
that's cool. I do use it. It is brilliant. I use it sometimes when yeah. I really have to watch something.
Yeah, I use it, you know, sometimes. There was an interview with David Simon on 5Live or something recently, and I wanted to get that and keep it to listen to properly sometimes, so yeah. I grabbed it for when I actually have time.
What format does it download it in?
Well, it downloads it in FLV, but then it can integrate with FFmpeg and stuff and convert it straight out.
But also, you have a choice. Or, you can yeah, get, you like, can, the iPad MP4 stream.
Yeah. You can tell it which format to download.
Oh, okay.
And it will convert it as in the program itself to whatever format you want.
That's pretty cool.
It's a really super cool application.
And lastly, a quick mention of Haiku OS. Alpha 3 is out. Haiku is the open source BOS clone. That we've been watching on and off for
yeah,
a few years.
Yeah, that's great. It's great. Didn't I? Yeah, I did do 30 days with Haiku, didn't I?
You did an article on it. Yeah, probably yeah. about 4 years ago.
It's
yeah.
cool. I even remember asking Benoit Schilling about it, and he was very proud of the fact that people were carrying on BOS. He worked on BOS.
Yeah. It's looking really, really good. They've got loads of improvements, more file systems, drivers, codecs, got printing support, loads of bugs fixed. And, you know, looking at the OS news comments, people are saying it's screamingly fast. It's dead simple because it's all created as one from the GUI down to the kernel. It's just a whole cohesive OS instead yeah, of yeah. lots of fragmented layers. So, wow. Yeah.
What must it be like?
I've never followed VOS or Haiku or anything. Can someone fill me in?
VOS was an operating system that was made in the early 90s for specialized PowerPC boxes, I think.
Right.
It was designed as a multimedia OS.
Right.
And it was later released on x86 hardware as well. It was monstrously fast.
Yeah. A little bit like Amiga OS, if you ever used that, but yeah. it had super low latency for things like multimedia applications yeah. in okay. particular. Ran executables, you know, you could just copy an executable and run it.
Yeah.
Right, so it was, okay.
Had a kind of clever fork, a bit like OS X, didn't it? A bit like Mac OS at the time.
Yeah.
In terms of data and the application resources.
Yeah. It was really, really good for its time. But there was a lot of problem with it. Microsoft being especially aggressive in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I think B Inc., the makers of it, sued Microsoft at one point. And although Microsoft didn't admit to basically having destroyed BOS, they gave B Inc. a large amount of money to pay them off. Well, allegedly.
Yeah.
To settle it.
Yeah. They came, at the time, a B machine was a small purple box that you just plugged into a right. monitor.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did see it as the spiritual successor to the Amiga, didn't they?
Yeah.
A fast, dead simple operating system, well integrated.
Yeah, which is why it still lives, I guess. Why the idea still lives.
Some people love it. Some people absolutely love the programming API.
Right.
And it could turn into a good little alternative OS.
Right.
Really well focused on the desktop from the ground up.
Yeah.
So, good luck to them. HaikuOS.org.
It's now time for discovery of the fortnight.
Yay!
Yeah.
Excellent.
We've all been busy not discovering things, although I've discovered something.
Cool.
Shall I go first?
Please.
Well, I've bored quite a few of you with my tales of what I did at the weekend, which was create a MAME arcade box PC to put in my living room.
Sounds really cool.
It is really cool. I'm really, really pleased with the results. I had an old motherboard and CPU lying around. I bought some memory and I bought a passively cooled Nvidia graphics card. It cost about £40. It actually wrote it down because it's one of their latest ones and didn't have great hardware support until recently. It's the Nvidia GT520. It's got an HDMI output on it, so I could take the HDMI output and put it straight into the TV. And one part of that discovery is that the GT520 works well with the very latest NVIDIA drivers and with a little bit of A-Sound RC messing around with, which is Ulsa's configuration file. I was able to get audio going out of the HDMI port directly into the TV or the amp without using any sound device on the motherboard. So you don't need anything else. You can just get music and arcade sounds coming out of your TV. So part of the discovery is that the 520, the audio can go through the HDMI port. And the other one is that I installed MAME. Now, of course, this is all legally dubious, but I investigated lots of different compiles of MAME, and SDL MAME running on Arch Linux is absolutely awesome. I mean, it's we've got a 40-inch LCD TV. You know, they're quite cheap these days, and it looks absolutely brilliant on it. It's just such brilliant nostalgia. It'll even have like the surrounds of the arcade machine if you happen to have the data.
Oh, cool.
And I used a load of I tried a load of different MAME front ends, because MAME is a command line executable. So if you want to actually control it with a joystick and sit on the sofa while you're doing it, you'd need a front end. And there isn't really an ideal MAME that there's Warcade, which lots of people use, but I couldn't get it to work easily enough. So my other discovery is something called QMC2, which is a Qt version of the MAME catalog launcher, version 2. It's a pretty standard Qt application, although it's incredibly fast. Even if you have thousands of games,
You do.
I'm not going to say that. It will show the image previews of each game, the circuit boards if you have them, the surrounds, and wiki information as well it links to. And you can set it up with an SDL game controller to be controllable from a joystick. And I just use my old PlayStation 2 controllers through a USB adapter. And the whole thing is just, it's a really great project, because it's Linux. You know, okay, it's using hardware and NVIDIA proprietary drivers, but the whole thing feels really exciting. And it's legally dubious on the ROM front, but everything else is well worth it if you actually legally own the ROMs yourself, which you might do, because plenty of PlayStation 2 games came with the ROMs in a folder for their Midway classics, for example.
So what games have you been playing?
Well, Asteroids is one of my favourites.
Really? The original Asteroids?
The original Asteroids. It's one of the first games I remember playing, so it actually kind of reveals my age. But Ghosts and Goblins, 1942, Double Dragon, 720. I spent a long summer playing 720 in the arcade machine, which is a skateboarding game with a weird joystick. There are loads of Phoenix. I really liked Phoenix, which is like a Galaxian's clone.
Have you completed Double Dragon, the arcade version?
I think I have, back in the day, with a friend. Cool. It depends on the setting, of course, but I think it was quite easy. It must have been set to easy, because it only cost us a few pounds.
Right, I remember putting 10p in there when I was 8 years old playing that game.
Oh, Renegade. Oh, there's loads of games. Arkanoid. Love that.
all anyway. Legally owned, of course.
So that's my discovery, is that Linux makes an awesome arcade machine. You guys? Andrew, got anything?
Yeah, I've got some vaguely Linux related. I think that's a lie. The Women's World Cup starts on pretty soon. That's a good discovery.
You're going to be watching it?
Yeah, you're going to Germany with Effie.
I'm not going to Germany with Effie, but I'll be going to my sofa, because you can watch all the England games by pressing the red button.
Really?
Got BBC.
Excellent. That's good to know.
The first game is on the 27th of June, and that's against some foreigners from Bolivia or Honduras or
Mexico.
That's it. That's it.
Effie would have known that.
No, doubtless they will be thrashed and sent home back to the Caribbean and sunshine and cheap beer and all those things that we don't miss in England. But my big discovery really is that the women's game is obviously nowhere near as much money in it. Because they don't have the Champions League, they don't have the big Premiership TV deals. So an England player, an England defender, two of them are on, I found out today, are on central contracts with the FA. How much do you reckon that the best women's defenders in the game get paid?
Are they professional?
Some of them aren't. Some of them are.
So,
but of the two professional players that I found out a salary for today.
Okay, sorry. Not very much.
£16,000 a year, when Wayne Rooney is on £150,000 a week. It's bizarre. Mad. It's absolutely crazy. And the game, the European Cup final against Germany 2 years ago, was a fantastic game of football. It ended 6-2. England losing because the Germans are professional players, so they're a lot fitter. But as long as when the fitness levels were equal, England were well in it. They were you know, properly digging in, and
unlike professional England,
well,
male players.
Unlike the men's team. So
who seem to be always tired and unfit and unable to play for 90 minutes.
From all their extracurricular activities.
Watch, you know, for an England team that you want to watch and that you want to win, rather than hating them for being millionaire 22-year-olds. The England women's football team, first match on the 27th of June.
Excellent.
Don't worry, you might be a millionaire 29-year-old at some point, Andrew. You can still do it.
Thanks, Mike. I cling to that dream.
John?
Yeah, I was just looking around on the internet before coming here, and I came across a story on Lifehacker about filter bubbles and how online, you know, Google changes your search results based on your history and what you like on Facebook, and, you know, people get dropped out of your Facebook feed if you don't click on their stories. And the guy was saying basically that this is really bad because we're only seeing stuff we agree with and stuff that's, you know, maybe relevant but not necessarily challenging or important.
Yeah.
So there were examples given of, you know, someone searching for Egypt during the height of the whole, you know, Egyptian Arab Spring bit, where one person searched it and got information about the Arab Spring and Tahrir Square and all that. Another person searched it and got information about holidays in Egypt and the CIA World Factbook and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's saying, you know, this is mad. This shouldn't be... This is actually a bad thing, you know, for the status of our democracy, for the quality of our society. It's a bad thing. And so, anyway, my discovery is DuckDuckGo, which is a search engine, which Mike tells me uses Bing.
Uses Bing results, Yahoo Bing results, sometimes Wolfram Alpha and stuff, a mixture of things,
So, and is really good. The quality of the results are really fantastic. But it doesn't do any of this customization. And what's more, it's really tight on privacy. So you can set it to use HTTPS by default. Don't collect any user data about you. They redirect your links that you click so that they can't see what search terms you entered to get to the site and stuff like that.
It can do search by HTTP post as well, so your search terms don't even appear in the URL when you click through to the search results.
Oh, that's really good.
It was just really interesting clicking around. So I recommend going to DuckDuckGo and A, using the search engine, and B, reading their about page and reading their pages on privacy and on the filter bubble, because both were really fascinating.
Yeah, I read that page as well a while back, and it's an interesting point you made about all this customization limiting your exposure to other information, and it showed, you know, some people searching the States might only get Fox News results for something they're searching about, and other people different news, and so you never actually broaden your mind, you never actually see something that challenges you or makes you learn something and think, maybe this is right, maybe this is different, and you just get narrowed down, and it's quite scary.
The other really interesting thing that I came across as well, for people who say, you know, big deal about this stuff, you know, about filter bubbles and privacy, but you know, while reading the links, there was a link from DuckDuckGo to a Wall Street Journal article, I think, about American insurance companies that are investigating whether or not it's possible to use all the data that's collected about you now, so your search history, your social networking information, you know, mail order stuff that you know, all of that stuff. Yeah. They're trying to find out whether or not they can predict life longevity based on this information, so that it may end up affecting, you know, your insurance premiums or life insurance or whatever, or your car insurance based on perhaps risky behavior, depending on what you search. So, you know, this stuff actually, it's getting to a point where it will genuinely impact you.
Yeah.
And people who say, you know, you wouldn't have people read your mail, you know, you need a search warrant to read your mail, and you need a judge's order to wiretap your phone line and stuff. This is the same deal. So it is important things. But yeah, check out DuckDuckGo, just really fascinating website to read around and a decent search engine to replace Google with. So
yeah, that's the thing that's impressed me. The search results are actually good as well. Yeah. It's all nice and well talking about all these freedom issues, but if the resulting service is bad, then it's a bit hard to use it. But I've used DuckDuckGo a bit in the last few weeks, and I've never had any problem with it.
I've just switched it as my default, so maybe in a couple of weeks I'll tell you what happens.
I think I might do as well,
I might do as well.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm a bit slow, but I'm reading Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, which is it's a famous book about how people create how you can almost instantly come up with an intuitive impression of something or someone or an idea on whether something is happens to be what it is. And the early chapters are about judging people's marriages by watching them talk for 3 minutes. There was an agency in the US that actually did this for research, and they actually did what Google does with your search results by looking for all these kind of telltale signs and how people talk and how they react, and were able to judge with 90-95% accuracy whether the marriage would last.
Really?
Whoa.
And that was just from the shortest time, just 3 minutes. So the longest time was just 15 minutes. And what Malcolm Gladwell is saying, that even in just a few seconds you can create a thin slice profile of something, and it tells you a hell of a lot about somebody's personality.
Yeah.
And just having read that at the same time and hearing you talking about what you can do with all those data, it begins to feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I found this with Google Mail as well. Back when I started using Google Mail, like we all did several years ago, they had adverts next to your messages, but the adverts were just related to the content of that individual message. So there'd be some automated scanning going on that picks out keywords and show adverts. Now, it seems these are not per email, but this information is constantly stored. So I had a conversation with somebody about 8 months ago about Zorbing, that where you get into a big inflatable ball and run around in the countryside. And I'm still getting adverts for that in my email now. So it's picking up all this data. Yeah. It's snowballing it. It's rolling it together. Yeah, all the things I've talked about.
Even if it's not kept the data, it's actually handed it on to the next cookie or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's doing something. It's not just per email. Yeah, that really scares me now, because there's some data on there. All the different things I talk about and like or dislike. It's strange.
Yeah.
Link to all your searches if you haven't disabled it in your Google account.
I've turned off search history.
Yeah.
I've turned off everything, basically. Yeah.
Thanks for that happy thought, John.
Yeah. Can I share one more discovery quickly? Yeah. Someone recommended in the best applications threads, MPD, Music Player Demon, with NCMPCC or something as a front end. Actually, I set it up yesterday and I love it. It's the best media player I've used.
What's so good about it?
It's just so simple. Like, okay, setting it up wasn't complicated, but it wasn't the most simple thing in the world. But the interface is command line. It's an NCursus interface. And it's just simple. It's easy. And I love it, the fact that I can listen to my music and it uses 10 megabytes of memory and not like 100 or whatever, other stuff uses. And it's all catalogued and it's all searchable.
Oh, awesome.
No album art, but yeah. And, I can just stream it elsewhere and it's fine. I love it. So thank you, whoever recommended that. I can't remember your name now, but...
What was it called? NSPCC?
That leaves you, Mike.
That just leaves me. Well, I've got two. The first one comes from when I was searching around Freshmeat for software for the cover disc a few weeks ago. And I came across perhaps the most stupid application name ever. And this is a server management tool.
Hang on, there have been some fairly stupid names in the past. Are you sure?
I think this
is bold claim. Is it more stupid than G-Scroz?
I think this even beats it, because its name is left bracket, capital R, right bracket, question mark, EX. Now, when I'm putting some software on the cover disk, I've got to put it in a directory with the name. The amount of escape codes I would have to put around the characters in the bash shell just to put that software on the disk, it's just not worth it. So, congratulations, R?EX brackets guy, with your very serious server management tool. It's such a stupid name that doesn't fit in with the Unix command line at all, that I'm not putting your software on the disk. So there.
Cool.
And my second discovery was, you guys all know about Arda, the digital audio workstation.
Yeah.
Well, I went to download that for the disc as well. So went onto the download page, clicked yay download at the bottom, and it said, oh, you haven't given us any money. And I looked down at the bottom and it said there was an automatic $45 donation to download Arda. This is a GPL program.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, what? $45? So I had to click into the box, delete 45 and type 0 to click continue, just to show how bad I am, that I'm not donating any money. At which point a big picture of the lead developer appeared and a series of check boxes as to why I'm not paying the money.
Really?
Yeah. So eventually I could get through and download the source, but it was real like pesterware.
I think I like it. I really like it as a
Yeah, John and I were talking about this last week. I think the conclusion was, or my conclusion was anyway, that if it makes a difference between him carrying on developing Arda or not, I'd rather he did it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but also put the donate lots of button
people
up
making
there.
Money from it.
But he charges for the binary downloads full stop, whereas the source code is available free of charge. So you can download it from your distribution repositories. Because they've taken the source code and built it for the distro.
Yeah.
But if you want to download the Mac binary or something, then you have to pay for it, which even $45 compared to what you pay for Cubase or something like that, it's a very reasonable price. And yeah, like you say,
if it makes a difference to him abandoning the project and carrying on, I don't mind it.
Yeah, but if it matters to him that much, he should just not have released it under the GPL. I think.
Well, no, because the GPL is not about not making money. It's about, you know, enabling collaboration and, you know, security and all of that. Richard Stallman always says the GPL is not about not making money.
Of course, but then put a big donate button up there. Put something, say, I could do this money. But pestering you and trying to make you feel guilty just put me off. I just thought that this guy is just, like, he's chosen to release his software under a license. You know,
choose a different license.
Choose a different license. Don't try and confuse the situation. Either release it for free and ask for donations.
I know what you mean, and I'd feel somewhat similar. But at the same time, I don't think he's dealing with people like us who are sensitive about the license issues. He's dealing mostly probably with OS X users who want a cheap Cubase alternative.
Right.
In a world that's saturated with people who charge a fortune for their software. And he probably just feels a bit miffed that lots of people are using it for free in commercial environments. And he wants to remind them that, you know, the reason why it's professional is because he needs money to keep it going.
Well, that's fine. Just charge for the Mac downloads, but don't pester me for trying to grab the source code. That's
yeah,
what I mean.
That's different. Yeah, what's really interesting, though, is the guy, the lead developer, actually cares passionately about free software and open source, as best as I can tell, because I'm going to include it in the article I'm writing, and looked into him a bit, and his little bio page, you know, talks about Linux as more than software, and just, you know, very brief, but actually really, really interesting. It's worth checking out.
And with such donation-avoiding fun, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come are the excellent results of our You Dare Us challenge, Speak Your Brains, and the ever-popular Open Ballot.
Right, so time for You Dare Us, and this fortnight we were going to try and install a Linux distro blindfolded. We're pretty bad at this.
Let's just move on.
I did try, and I first of all tried with Ubuntu, and there were some instructions on it, but it's really hit or miss to get the screen reader to start up.
So is this like normal Ubuntu?
Normal Ubuntu. So it is on there, which is excellent.
So you boot into you presumably put the disk in the drive, turn the machine on, you leave it until it
no. So what you have to do is, A, you have to use 10.04,
right.
Because after that, the screen reader can't read out Ubiquiti's screen, so it's useless for installing with a screen reader.
That's really shocking, isn't it?
Right. Secondly, you have to put the disk in the drive, wait for the computer to boot, but you have to press spacebar to get to the Ubuntu, like, boot selection screen at the right moment in the boot process. So how are you meant to do that if
Why?
You're blind?
Because you've got to choose a specific
because
option.
You've then got to select English as the language, then press F5 and choose the accessibility option you want, press enter, and then press enter again to get it to boot with the screen reader starting up.
That sounds terrible.
Which, you know, if you're blind, you're going to need, I think you'd have to have a friend to help you. I don't know, like, I'm sure, you know, you probably learn to cope. I don't know. I've never had any blind friends or anything. I imagine you'd learn to cope a bit, but it doesn't seem easy. So anyway, and then even once I got it to boot, looking at the screen, I must confess, I found that the screen reader crashed. Well, I think it crashed on the second screen of Ubiquiti every time. So I couldn't get past that without looking.
The screen reader is actually a speech synthesizer.
Yeah, it's Orca,
right.
Which is the name desktop screen reader.
Does that just read out whatever's in front?
Yeah, it'll read whatever's out on the screen and whatever you highlight.
How does it present things as an input? Or doesn't it?
Quit button, I think it said something like that.
Right, right.
And so it's, you know, it probably is workable if it worked, but it didn't work. So Then I tried Phoenix because we had an article in Linux Format about accessibility, and the guy who wrote that is also the lead developer of Phoenix, which is a distribution specifically designed for visually impaired people. And that actually by default boots with the screen reader, so you don't have to do any fiddling with the boot command options
right.
and stuff.
Just put the disk in the
drive. Yeah, and go, and you get Orca starting up by default. But once again, Orca crashes while using Ubiquiti, so I was unable to get very far with that either. So, and there are all kinds of caveats to Phoenix as well about not upgrading packages after you've got it installed. And on the whole, I'm disappointed to say that it seems like it's going to be a real challenge.
If you're blind, you're not going to choose Linux.
Yeah, I don't think so. But, you know, if you have a friend to install it for you, maybe.
If you have a friend to install it for you and use the Linux screen reader and screen magnifiers and stuff, then you avoid the absolutely horrendous licensing fees that you do on, on Windows accessibility software.
Yeah.
Like, and hundreds of pounds.
I think, you know, the screen reader's one thing, but the screen magnifiers and, you know, low, you know, high contrast and low contrast themes and stuff for different visual disabilities, I think they all work really well. But the screen reader does seem a bit hit or miss, so the challenge kind of failed there.
A lot of it might be to do with all the multiple layers of the GUI as well. So, you know, you've got something that's trying to read out widgets on the screen, but with so many different toolkits and layers, it gets really complicated.
Well, Orca, it doesn't work with every application either, so you have to be selective. It struggles with Firefox and OpenOffice, reportedly.
Really?
So,
I think that's the Linux desktop fragmentation really showing its bad side there then, because of just all these different toolkits and stuff. I think if I was blind, I'd use Linux at the command line, because I think it worked really, really well there. You've got
that's good.
The Lynx web browser is excellent, and this, you know, you get plenty of the screen reading software works really well at the command line, because it's just text. You know, so you'd have to sacrifice a few things, but you know, great email clients, great IRC clients, read Wikipedia well.
So maybe I should have tried that perhaps, but it'd be interesting to know how that goes, because I suppose if you are blind, you know, not, I don't want to say, you know, but maybe not having a GUI is not the end of the world. I don't know.
It might be easier because.
It might be easier.
Yeah, having all this, you know, you're hovering over a checkbox is kind
of. Yeah, typing the commands rather than having to move the mouse around is probably going to be a lot easier.
Yeah, I think you just have to, you'd find that easier in the long term. Yeah,
also, a Braille reader presumably would be a lot easier to use when it's versus command line based.
But, you know, if we've got any blind listeners or any visually impaired listeners or anybody with any disability, I'd love to hear from you in the comments about how you get by on Linux.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting.
Yeah, we might be able to follow it up.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So for the next fortnight, we need a new challenge. Graham and me were talking about this earlier. I don't know if this needs to go in the podcast. Me and Graham were talking about this earlier. Maybe we should consider a replacement for You Dare Us, since we failed quite consistently.
Speak Your Brains was designed to be the replacement, wasn't it?
No, Speak Your Brains was a replacement for In the Hot Seat.
Yeah, it became the replacement from In the Hot Seat, but I'm sure at the time we thought, we can't do You Dare Us anymore. We but then we all got a bit fed up with In the Hot Seat.
Shall we bring In the Hot Seat back?
Yeah, we could do.
Just drop you. We could just switch it around and depend what we feel like doing each week.
So, I guess the challenge then, is this what you're saying, John, is that we've come up with a better idea and listeners as well.
If we don't do this, is it like dividing by zero? Do we destroy the universe?
Let's see.
So the world might end if we fail to come up with an alternative. So actually, please make an effort. Send us some information if you don't want the world to end. Send us some suggestions for You Dare Us alternatives. Otherwise, the world will end.
But you might want the world to end, you know. So go ahead, read it.
Excellent.
Okay, Speak Your Brains is still just about clinging on to life. I got three emails.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah, it's not bad. I actually got four emails, but one of them was a really complicated question about video cards. That's not something I'm going to read out on a podcast. So meanwhile, Samuel Tarling says, could I just publicly shout out a massive thank you for the unappreciated live chat helpers at support.mozilla.com? I'm normally a maintainer with Mozilla in my spare time, but after a break I decided to help out on the live chat, and after two quite painful hours of, hey, can you help? It's not working. Why isn't it working? Can you fix it? Is it fixable? Hello, can you fix it? I now have a newfound respect for the people who devote more time than I could.
I didn't even realise they were live.
No.
Yeah. I didn't know about that either, but yeah, he says he's got a lot of respect for these people who help one another one-to-one.
That's brilliant. I mean, we understand something of that with the phone calls that we normally get.
Yeah.
Is that Linux?
Hello.
Can I get my Windows installation back?
I've got this little flashing white dot on my screen.
What's my password?
By and large, people do try and help themselves when you get a decent amount of information from them. But because Firefox is so huge, because it's 200 million downloads now, I'd imagine you will have quite a lot of untechnical users asking you questions. And yeah, then trolls yeah. as well. So, yeah, respect to Mr. Samuel Tarling. Then Frank Duer, with an umlaut, says, I'm a proud owner of an EPC 701. As a long-time Linux user who has stared into a few black screens when installing Linux on a laptop, I appreciated Asus selling a Linux netbook, but it soon abandoned us, offering practically no updates, let alone a dist upgrade for Zandros. It also sported Asus recommends Windows Vista on its ads, which is why Asus's announcements... I've said Asus and Asus, haven't I? Why Asus's announcement to offer Ubuntu on netbooks doesn't really excite me. Ubuntu 10.10 is not an LTS release and will soon phase out and represent the same problem as Zandros did. I've long installed Ubuntu on my EPC and never looked back. Mm. I think that was a real problem with a lot of the early netbooks in that they came with distributions that made no sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
We've said this so many times.
Last time we talked about it, didn't we? I think we falsely attributed Limpus to the EPC when it was Zandros.
It was on the
Aspire 1.
Aspire 1, right.
Yeah. But, yeah, I couldn't understand those decisions at the time. Okay, so they customised it a bit, but you can do that with any distribution. Yeah. But, you know, people get this, they go into a forum and say, oh, I want to install something on Linux. What version are you running? Linspire? Nobody's got any idea. If you know, more distros then started to use Ubuntu Netbook Remix as a kind of standard Linux, which made a lot more sense, easier to get help for, easier to get applications.
Yeah.
So I see his point. And finally, Jared Isaacson says, hey, can you give a plug to one of the ideas on Ubuntu Brainstorm? This is an elevator pitch, whatever that means. Help open source by making an ecosystem of donations in the Ubuntu Software Center. It says you can search Google for idea 21212 and this will come up. So, you know, this Ubuntu Brainstorm site where they put all these ideas together, and some people come up with the idea of being able to donate directly to open source projects through the Software Center. So you only need one account. You don't need, you know, think, is it PayPal? Do I have to send a check?
Yeah. Credit card details all over the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Is
Although
it legit?
Will Canonical want to take a 75% cut of donations?
That would be pretty dodgy. Yeah. But I think, yeah, if it's done right, it could be a really good idea, because...
How can it be bad?
Yeah. if it's just a click, you know, donate a dollar.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that'll work better than somebody pestering you to give $45 for downloading source code. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, love it.
Mm. So, yeah, that's Speak Your Brains.
Yeah, really good.
We'd love this section to continue because it's great fun. So please email me, mike.saunders@futurenet.com, with Speak Your Brains in the subject line, and tell us anything. Have a rant, have a joke, ask a question, as long as it isn't too technical.
Tell us about your favourite pub.
Tell us about your favourite pub, your favourite beer, your favourite country, your favourite animal, your favourite ship in Frontier. and if it's good, we'll read out your message on the air.
It's time for... Open ballots.
What?
It's time for open ballots. As you may have seen, if you're one of the lucky people who subscribe to Linux Format and get Linux Format therefore earlier than it appears in the shops, Ubuntu has now fallen behind both Fedora and Mint in the distro watch charts. Mm-hmm. So our question was: is Ubuntu on the way out? Has the narwhal's goose been cooked? Is the hedgehog a late parrot? and all of that. Is anybody still running Ubuntu? I remember we all tried it, haven't we, at some point?
Ubuntu?
Yeah.
Yeah, I ran Kubuntu for a good couple of years. And only recently switched to Arch.
What made you switch?
I just wanted to try something new. To be honest, Kubuntu's pretty good and doesn't suffer any... I haven't suffered any of the Unity stuff or the user interface messing around with. Kubuntu is a pretty good version of KDE running straight from the start. But Arch, it's been so much fun. It's been like rediscovering why we got into Linux in the first place. It's cool, and KDE does run quite a bit faster on it too.
You've been an Arch user for a while, haven't you, John?
Not massively long, but before that, as Fedora, I've never really been an Ubuntu user.
So this doesn't really apply to you then, does it?
No. Just,
just go off to the pub now.
Yeah. I'll see you guys later.
bye, John. Well, I've been running Zubuntu for the last few years, so I've avoided all the upheavals on the desktop and all the different plans for title bar notifications and then Unity and then Wayland and stuff like that, or that might hit me at some point. But my experience has stayed mostly the same over the last few years. A big selection of up-to-date Debian packages and XFCE. Great. Yeah, yeah. Does fine for me. So I haven't been hit by this, but I just see a big fork coming here between traditional Linux users who want a normal kind of desktop, where Ubuntu's going, where Canonical's going with Ubuntu, with Unity. They're targeting somebody else. Now, that's fine. They may make billions of pounds eventually doing that. They may become the world's biggest OS provider in 20 years. But it's just, I think a lot of normal Linux users feeling left behind. They're not part of this process anymore. So I think this is why Mint's been popular. Mint is
what Ubuntu was.
What Ubuntu was, yeah. But Mint needs Ubuntu, so it's strange.
That's certainly what most people have said on Tux Radar when we asked this question. Mint, Fedora, and also Arch seem to be the ones, the distros that people are migrating to. Where are we here? Yes, Jargon, not verified, says, some of the reasons you see Ubuntu declining are Shuttleworth's utter disregard for the community. And other reasons after that. Is that really a fair accusation?
No, I don't think so.
I can see where they're coming from with stuff like Windicators and all that stuff. Like, where did that come from? And yeah, who really wanted that? And who really wanted Unity?
But so what if Mark Shuttleworth makes a distribution in his...
Yeah, no, yeah.
Exactly
it's,
what
yeah.
he wants to do.
But I think, you know, if that's given... Not saying it's a bad thing, but it might be given as an explanation for why Ubuntu might be seen to be declining in popularity.
But I think there's... Yeah, it might be the reason... Maybe his choices haven't been right, but the fact that it hasn't been ratified by committee, yeah. all of the changes isn't...
It's not... Thing. No, not a bad thing, just an explanation.
Yeah. There were quite a few comments on the way that the numbers have been counted, and I thought that was quite fair.
Yeah.
At DistroWatch, that, you know, it might not be that important or significant in any way, or maybe all the top three have grown. So they've all grown slightly. It's just that Ubuntu's grown at a less rate than Fedora Mint.
Yeah, but I think you can't deduce too much from statistics, but just looking at the general feedback around the internet as well. I moderate our Linux format forums, and I read most posts on there, and a lot of people are unhappy with Udity. A lot of people are moving away from it. So
we've talked about it, and we all think making it the default choice is slightly mad.
Yeah.
Yes, crazy choice. Back to the statistical analysis. Avilela says that in the last month all of the top distros have gone down, with only Zorin in 12th place gaining in popularity. Mm-hmm. So that means overall numbers are all down. But then Buzzomatic says it is down over the last month, but it's still quite a way up from where it was 3 months ago and also where it was 6 months ago. So that downward trend of the overall numbers seems to be just a blip, whereas the relative fall of Ubuntu is part of a longer term trend.
And it is just DistroWatch as well.
It's just DistroWatch, yeah. We don't have any sales figures
no.
for Linux, with it being free and all. But that's it, you know, it's a rough metric. I think we can all see that something like Mint or Fedora and Ubuntu that are in the top three of the DistroWatch charts are a lot more popular than, I don't know, Pardis or Slackware. Something that's not really going to trouble the top 10.
And for a long time, it seemed, maybe even 2 years, Ubuntu was so dominant as the distro that everybody wanted to write about, that everybody was installing. It was the breakthrough distribution for people who didn't know what Linux was. And I don't know whether this is the end of that honeymoon period or a darker phase for Ubuntu, but things have changed.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, when my parents just got a new laptop, they run Linux, and I was trying to decide what to get, you know, to install, get them to install, and I didn't want to recommend Ubuntu anymore because of Unity. I think that's what they are running at the minute. But, you know, I was kind of at a bit of a loss, like, I don't think Mint.
Did you recommend?
I said I don't think we've got around to trying it. I suggested Mint or Magaya or whatever. Yeah. But I don't think they got around to changing it. But I didn't think, you know, who knows if Unity's still going to be there in 6 months, a year's time, or whatever. And you know, it's just unfamiliar. It's not.
Well, it's not transferable either.
Yeah.
You know, if you have to move to a different version of Linux in the future, or even to Windows OS 10, you know, your Unity skills are going to be pretty redundant.
And at the same time as well, though, suggesting other distros, I suppose Mint would be the best solution here. But the driver support on Ubuntu is still, that's what made it really good.
The installer
and the driver support, you know, that it did put the proprietary stuff on there just to get your hardware working out of the box. And, you know, that's what made Ubuntu good. And the stuff that's making... Yeah, maybe.
Can I come in here with a few pro-Ubuntu points from the comments? TG Andrews says, people whine about Unity because it is new and they have to relearn what they've known for years. Knowing something doesn't make it better. The guys and gals at Canonical are smart people, just like in Cupertino and Redmond, and they won't have taken this decision lightly.
No, but they forced it upon everyone.
They don't force you to install Ubuntu.
No, but if you're an Ubuntu user and you use the GNOME desktop, you're going to be forced to use Unity or Switch.
But then lots of people think that Ubuntu rocks. Like anonymous Ubuntu fanboy who says, Unity rocks. I think Mark and the Ubuntu developers have shown great vision by introducing Unity at this point. It has invigorated the project and turned Ubuntu from being a run-of-the-mill GNOME desktop distribution something new and exciting with huge potential. And Chris Cook says that the stats probably reflect the dissatisfaction of some users looking to jump ship. That's only looking. It doesn't mean that they have left or won't be back when they remember that Ubuntu rocks. I'm using Ubuntu with classic interface. I will try Unity again after the next release. It does have its adherents, its defenders out there.
Maybe it's just going to be very divisive. I mean, people are quite touchy about the desktops. People spend a lot of time customizing them. I read sites like Engadget, and when Apple announces a new version of OS X with a feature like Stacks or something, there are hundreds of comments of people saying, oh, this has changed, I'm not going to use this because it's just a minor tweak to their beloved desktop. And so maybe people are just too precious about it. And I don't know. I love my XFCE, you could pry that out of my cold, dead hands. Oh,
Prolific Puffin also likes XFCE.
Yay!
Says, I personally reverted to 10.04 for the extra year of updates and added another partition with Ubuntu 11.4 on both 11.04 on both of my machines when it happened. I stated plainly that Mint was going to pass Ubuntu by. I was right. XFCE forever.
I like the way he said, when it happened. It just one night, everything changed.
Yeah, so Debian but better and with XFCE. It's pretty damn good, really.
Yeah, more up-to-date Debian.
What are the other Mint versions like? I know there's a Debian edition and, there's some other versions of Mint, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there are like respins, aren't there? I'm sure you can get Mint.
And there's a rolling version as well.
Yeah, I think that's based on Debian.
Right.
Yeah.
Interested to know what that's like.
Well, I'm really interested to see now if Mint becomes the standard distribution of choice for more experienced Linux users or those who want a traditional desktop, then we're going to be in a very, very unusual situation because Mint is 99% Ubuntu, just with various tweaks and customizations. So Mint needs Ubuntu.
Mm.
And if Mint users are expecting Mint to be, you know, the proper Linux that doesn't do all this daft, silly stuff, then they're going to have problems in the future when Ubuntu takes on Wayland.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's quite easy for Mint to just stick on the older GNOME desktop and say, here you go, the Ubuntu you all loved before. But as Ubuntu moves to Wayland...
Wayland might be all right, though. I'm not as scared of Wayland as I am of Unity.
Mm.
No, as long as it's done properly on the development side, it shouldn't affect users.
Yeah, and it might actually bring lots of advantages for users.
Just run faster, smoother.
But I think it's more likely in that case that, you know, in a couple of years, a year's time, maybe Ubuntu will look at Mint's success and think, maybe we made a mistake making Unity the default choice and maybe roll back to something more similar to what Mint is providing or create another Ubuntu edition, which they must have discussed internally, you know, the Unity edition for people that like it. Unity and the Ubuntu desktop versions.
Yeah, perhaps a bit more a clearer message from Canonical would be good here. If they were to say, you know, look, we realise these decisions aren't popular, but we're moving on now from the home desktop 1-2% Linux.
Or from winning Linux users to winning new users.
Winning new users, yeah. So that's a very different proposition there. So, you know, they've given up on our tiny little 1-2% market and they're actually going after Apple and Microsoft and really big type, you know, the future mobile devices. And
well, the full screen search thing in Unity is very similar to that used in Lion, Mac OS X Lion, which has not been released yet, has it?
No.
July?
July, I think.
So that's an example of Linux leading the way in you know, bold alternative desktop paradigms.
But it's also very similar to the name shell activities overlay, isn't it?
It is. But I'm not suggesting that this is an exclusively an Ubuntu win. It's a Linux win.
Yeah. No, yeah, definitely.
Just if it's a win.
Just pains me to see the duplication.
Yeah. I think two things have come along at the same time here, Unity and GNOME Shell, which has really compounded the situation. So it's not a battle now between traditional GNOME and Unity. It's not even, you know, traditional GNOME fans are feeling lost because Ubuntu's gone off in one direction, the GNOME team themselves have gone off in another direction. Yeah. And so lots of things have been thrown up in the air at once. Now, when it all settles in 5 years' time, it might be really, really good. But in the meantime, it's leaving a lot of old school Linux users feeling rather lost.
How long did it take KDE 4 to get good?
Oh, forever.
It's not happened.
2024, I think, was the schedule.
5 years, isn't it? It's been a long time. I don't know. It's at least three. We did so many cover features on KDE. It's almost good now.
But it is good now.
I think it now, is now.
KDE is good.
I'm really enjoying it again.
One slight naysayer, Anonymous Penguin X, says, actually, I'm not that impressed with Mint. It has an old-fashioned Windows XP feel. It's Linux for people who would rather be on Windows and don't want to take any risks, and the whole attitude of Ubuntu done right is frankly cloying. It's good that Canonical is trying to mix things up a bit. More choice and risk-taking is a good thing. Kind of agree there, really.
Yeah.
Mint is too much like XP with the big menu thing that comes up from the bottom left.
I find that menu ridiculous.
I don't like it. Yeah.
I can't use that.
I got rid of it on my work machine, but then I didn't put proper GNOME back very well, so I've made a right mess of the display.
Have you got Frankenstein GNOME installation?
It's rubbish.
And with such Ubuntu...
Stop!
What? Who?
Hammer time.
It's time for one more thing.
Ah, oh, brilliant. I knew you'd do a good job of it.
Thanks, Mike. In the news story that you sent us a link to, which will doubtless be on the podcast notes, about the inclusion or the possible inclusion of Chrome in Ubuntu...
Ah, yeah.
There was a link off to a story or a quote from Richard Stallman. Now... How did Richard Stallman describe cell phones?
iMoan and iBad. No, that was our interview with him. Portable monitoring government spy devices.
That's a good one, John.
Play along at home, listeners.
Brain sucking. I don't know.
No.
Earworms.
Your government lapdog.
Stalin's dream.
That's quite good. I think, yeah, I like that.
Cell phones are Stallman, : cell phones are Stalin's dream, says free software movement founder.
Was that the headline?
Yeah.
It would have been a really awesome great headline. Yeah. Search engine fodder.
How do you get in touch with Richard Stallman then? You want to just have a natter with him?
No, you're the only one who's spoken to him.
He's listening now.
How does he order a pizza? Really? How does he play Angry Birds? He can probably play it on Chromium, actually.
Probably IRC. Somebody gave me a pizza.
And it just happened. Yeah.
He has an IRC bot connected to him.
Thanks, Andrew. That was excellent. And from now on, you can do one more thing if you like. Andrew has volunteered. He's got a big smile on his face. So look forward, listeners, to the next few months of Andrew's One More Things. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. It's such an